And, fascinated, Brazier then set out to manoeuvre himself into a position that made polite exchange inevitable, only to be forced to contend with the presence of said aunt. She being a woman of pinched expression and a very steely determination to the point of being downright rude, had made normal banter impossible. Yet, brief and constrained as it had been talking to Betsy, he'd sensed a spark of interest prior to a requirement to move on. That, of course, had come with the caveat of wishful thinking. The circles in which Edward Brazier had moved in the West Indies, if you excluded those purely to do with naval service, had been small, consisting of plantation owners, government officials, and factors engaged in the sugar trade, which included the importation and auctioning of slaves, an activity of which he had heartily and vocally disapproved. Normally, he had tended to avoid too many of these gatherings at which he regularly met the same people, albeit, as the second most senior naval officer on the station, he was ever in receipt of an invite. Added to his other reservations had been the presence of his superior, Admiral Hassel, he a constant attendee at both these soirees and the inevitable punch bowl spiced with rum. Since they had not seen eye to eye on certain matters, disputes that would surface when Hassel was inebriated meeting him outside official necessity had been best avoided. The governor's annual garden party held in the grounds of his official residence had demanded attendance, where it had been interesting to see how many people had avoided engaging with him. Edward Brazier had naturally been held in some regard for his rank as a senior post-captain. In terms of reputation locally, that had become somewhat muted by his activities. As the commanding officer of the 32-gun frigate HMS Diomede, he had been assiduous, many said too much so, and that included Admiral Hassel, in pursuit of those seeking to break the embargo of the Navigation Acts. These stated no produce could be imported into the Crown-owned colonies that was not carried in British vessels. In essence, this meant it had to come from home ports such as Bristol. Prior to the American War, much of what was required for comfort had been brought in, albeit illegally, from their fellow colonists to the north, with a blind eye being turned to the trade by officialdom. But not any more. The newly minted United States, if not quite enemies, were nevertheless not seen by Albion as friends to indulge. Fetching every one of the necessities for both comfort and business over 3,000 miles of ocean added significantly to the cost, which was much resented by those faced with the bill. The Carolinas, North and South, upped their game now they were independent, the blind eye having not entirely gone away. If it was no longer officialdom winking, it was maintained by a planter society that had, with the Americans, a shared interest. The task of King George's Navy was to stop it. Not that his commanding admiral rated it as a priority. This had formed the bone of contention with his superior, over which they had argued with some passion, and perhaps too loudly for good sense. Brazier needed to know where, and if he was officially supported. It had thus become politic to engage Kitty Clark at the social events he had chosen to attend, which had nothing to do with an interest in gossip or attractive females. It had emerged there was a plan by a group of planters and tradesfolk to sue him for their losses. Given the judges in the local courts were closer to a tolerance of their point of view than his own, it seemed possible they could well succeed, which might have seen him locked up, and worse, made personally liable for damages to cover their costs. "I take it Hassel is equivocating?" Kitty Clark had inquired, met with a flick of his eyebrows for raising the subject. Outright condemnation was unwise even with her. "I'm far from sure I have his full backing." There had been an implied question in his response. What would keep his detractors at bay? What was the attitude of the governor? And, while he balked at the notion of asking the man himself, too direct a query might produce too definitive a negative answer, he had seen no problem in aiming a hint at his wife. "My husband will hold them off, Brazier." "Can I be sure of that?" Kitty Clark had been a stunning beauty as a young woman, and there was much evidence of it still. But it was not an attribute to survive any trace of exasperation. Emotion changed her countenance in a remarkable way, and it had done so then. She had gone from faded attractiveness to termagant in a split second.
"He will answer to me if he fails to do so. The king's law must be upheld."
"You have no idea how reassuring I find that to be."
Which had contained a touch of sophistry. It had been common knowledge the governor, Colonel Alured Clark, doted on Kitty and was wont to seek her advice on matters of contention. Not that he was weak in any way. He was, after all, a much lauded soldier as well as a royal favourite. But his position on the island rendered him isolated when it came to advice, so he was given to relying on his forthright and brutally honest wife as a sounding board. Her attention had wandered as her angry expression relaxed, the fan waving once more, even under a parasol in place to ward off the heat.
"Do I see a certain lady arriving, Brazier? One I recall of some interest to you?"
The pointed fan had shown Betsy Langridge, descending from a covered carriage, her parasol opening at once, for the sun was strong and the normally cooling breeze slight. He had managed to talk to her on two other occasions, though it could not have been said to extend to much more than exchanged pleasantries. The presence of Sarah Lovell had posed a constant barrier to anything more, which did not apply just to him. It had even extended to a royal prince, albeit the one in question, William, deserved every rebuff he encountered, and he got a very public one from Betsy Langridge. She was far from alone. Touring the Caribbean in command of his frigate, Prince William had, given his boorish behaviour, left behind a bad odour in every island he visited. Especially outré in drink, this rendered no woman safe from his outrageous sallies and salacious suggestiveness, like the pleasure and kudos to be had from bedding a blood royal. More than one husband had required to be dissuaded from calling him out, a task that often fell to Edward Brazier, and they had crossed swords in another context. Admiral Hassel, whose responsibility it should have been, had declined to haul William up with a round turn for his want of decent manners, no doubt for fear of the latter's father and the effect it might have on his career. Then came William's martinet behaviour aboard ship, where he had publicly humiliated his first lieutenant, delivered in such a manner as to leave the poor fellow no choice but to demand a court-martial to adjudicate on his competence, a court at which Brazier had been obliged to act as the senior adjudicator. The verdict, which he was called on to deliver, had come close to being a public rebuke to Prince William. That, troubling as it was to recall, had soon ceased to be a matter to dwell upon. His eye and mind had turned to Betsy Langridge and to the problems posed by the continuous presence and blatant disapproval of her aunt, one he felt was not shared by her charge. Attraction is not necessarily demonstrated in words, however few, and he had seen in her expression, in particular in her eyes, that his attentions were not unwelcome. Once more, thinking of how to surmount the Lovell barrier, Kitty Clark had put her finger on the matter.
"Time to be bold, Brazier. Rumour has it she has booked passage and will be off back to England soon. Time and tide, sir."
Thinking on that, and stood naked in the backyard of Quebec House, as Joe Lascelles doused him with warm water to wash off the salt of the sea. He recalled those words, which had led to a determination not to be deflected. He had headed straight for Betsy, ignoring the fact she was in conversation with another possible suitor to quite rudely cut in on their conversation, in a way that had forced the poor soul to retreat.
"I'm told you are shortly to leave us, Mrs. Langridge."
"Is that of any interest to you, sir?"
came from Sarah Lovell. Betsy, on the other hand, had smiled, and nodded in a way that indicated a measure of regret. Emboldened, he had replied,
"It is surely so when the island will be much diminished by the loss, as will I."
Lovell's parasol spun furiously.
"By the Lord, sir, you are overbold."
Brazier had ignored her and looked hard at Betsy, but with a care to keep his voice soft. The smile he had aimed at her was meant as both a message and one he wished to be taken as utterly genuine.
"I cannot feel we have had enough time to properly acquaint ourselves."
"And you would wish that altered, Captain?"
"I would most certainly like it to be so."
"Elizabeth, I see the Governor looking in our direction. I do believe he wishes our presence."
That had been responded to with a sweet smile, even if the words were outright rejection.
"He has any number of people who want his attention, Aunt Sarah. So I do not fear he will miss ours. If you wish to engage with him, please feel free to do so."
The intake of breath was audible, but Lovell had not moved, as Brazier used a shoulder to partially cut her off.
"Is it true you're leaving?"
A nod.
"To return to?"
"Deal, in Kent. My family home."
"Which is?"
"Cottington Court, just outside the town. It overlooks the anchorage."
"It's a part of the world with which I am unfamiliar,"
had seemed a banal rejoinder.
"I have touched at the Downs, of course, but spent no time there."
Another sweet and engaging smile.
"Then you may find much of interest, should you do so."
The sound coming from her aunt's throat then would not have shamed a person dying from the bloody flux, being half cough and half groan. But her charge was not going to be deflected.
"But I do not leave before race day. So perhaps we will come across each other there."
"Would I be allowed to ask for a commitment to that?"
"You most certainly would not,"
Sarah Lovell had snapped. The look on Betsy's face, especially the twinkle in her eyes, had stated the precise opposite.
"Perhaps you will enter and race, Captain."
"I'm a man at home on the deck of a ship, Mrs. Langridge, not the back of a horse."
"Quite daring in that milieu, I'm informed."
So she had been asking about him.
"I suspect you would be audacious mounted if you were more familiar with horses."
"Audacity would scarce keep me in the saddle, Mrs. Langridge. But in other things besides horsemanship, I might be seen to be foolhardy."
"Elizabeth, I fear I'm suffering from too much heat."
They had both so nearly laughed, not at the excuse being made, but at a connection between them, the sharing of a similar thought. If heat was being generated, it was in the look exchanged, or perhaps in the palpitations of the Lovell concerns. Tight control had been necessary for Edward Brazier to keep a straight face. It had been impossible to miss the tightness of Betsy's jaw as she fought a similar affliction.
"Perhaps a cooling drink, Aunt Sarah."
"Allow me to escort you to the Marquis."
"That would be most kind, Captain Brazier."
His intention to take Betsy's arm had been thwarted by determination. Sarah Lovell got between them to ensure it could not be, which left him with a dilemma. Did he take her arm, this being something her niece alluded to with a mischievous grin?
"I'm sure my aunt would welcome your support, Captain."
given willingly, he had said, to have it rudely refused. If mutual attraction had finally been cemented, it had happened at the race day, even if it was all in gesture and gentle innuendo. With crowds occasionally surging to watch the horses speed by added to the sound of thudding hooves, Sarah Lovell's immediate presence and her ability to overhear had become severely curtailed. When he gently put his hand on Betsy's back to edge her towards the approaching runners, she had offered no resistance, which was reassuring, while, with the crowd closing behind them, her aunt had become marooned. Even more telling was the slight frisson he had felt running up his arm on contact, like a current of electricity. Did she feel it too? It was not a question he could ask. "Would you be offended if I was to say I will miss you?"
How could anyone be put out by such a compliment?
"I'm forced to wonder what it is you're going back to."
"Just my brother and my home."
"I've never commiserated with you for your loss. I have a feeling I would have liked your late husband."
"He was a man easy to like, Captain Brazier."
"Would that be a hard condition to replicate?" He had felt her tense then, and he knew why, for that was very close to a step too far. The mounts had sped by at the same time, their hooves throwing up clods of the heavily watered earth, one heading straight for Betsy's face. As she had recoiled into his hand, he had held her firmly, reaching out with the other to catch it in mid-air. With an exaggerated bow, he then presented it to her. "A souvenir to remember the day by, Mrs. Langridge. And perhaps to remember me also."
Passage might have been booked, but the ship in which she would travel had yet to arrive, such things being seasonal. Much in the nature of duty happened in the meantime, which had kept Brazier from any further pursuit. There was the sudden and mysterious death of Admiral Hassel while he was on patrol, immediately after which HMS Diomede had put to sea a second time, for a cruise that saw the deceased admiral buried with fitting ceremony. That was only one part of his purpose. Remaining at sea, having been supplied with intelligence as to where it would be intercepted, Brazier had gone on to capture and bring back to Kingston Harbour the Spanish plate ship he had set off to intercept. He had also brought in prisoners from the French privateer to which the Santa Clara had fallen, their ship having been sent to the bottom of the sea. This had added much to the general talk of a colony in which one day tended to meld into another. With little in the way of incident, Hassel's untimely demise, the subject of curious speculation soon faded from the gossip, in favour of conjecture on how much Brazier and his crew had earned from their Spanish prize. If fabulous figures had been bandied about, there was no doubt in anyone's mind. The gains were substantial. He had met Betsy one more time, at a ball given by Kitty Clark to celebrate his good fortune, one more occasion when every indication he could detect pointed towards a mutual magnetism. He could recall clearly, as he dressed himself, Sarah Lovell's parting shot when it had been time to depart, as well as the pinched expression that accompanied it.
"Goodbye, Captain Brazier. I doubt we shall meet again."
He had looked at Betsy then, hoping she would counter the sentiment, but she had merely dropped her gaze, to leave him in excruciating limbo. Chapter 4. Henry Tulkington could scarce avoid noticing the heavy blackening round John Hawker's right eye. With no desire to be caught staring, he turned away, as he often did, to stand by the stove, removing his gloves and warming his hands over the bowl of herbs sat on top. They were placed to take away the noxious, all-pervading odours of the slaughterhouse and tannery. The noise of dying animals when slaughter was in progress was harder to disguise. The bruise was large, bluish, going yellow at the edges, which did nothing for a countenance far from flattering to begin with. With his large head and pockmarked face, as well as a nose that showed evidence of many a thump, Hawker would have struggled to claim allure. He also had a rough, gravel voice allied to an expression which, as it implied a threat of violence, rendered him generally disagreeable. That said, Hawker always addressed Henry Tulkington with respect, even if on this day he was in dispute with a proposal.
"I won't say I's happy with having any of Spafford's lot get involved in our affairs."
"Why?" was delivered in a level tone, with a back still turned.
"They're a mouthy lot, and tavern boasters, who we can't keep locked away forever. Let loose, they're not like to keep quiet about last night either, regardless of threat. It'll be all over Deal and Beyond in a week. Might be, anyway, since we missed Daisy Trotter."
"He's on his own. And, from what you tell me, no great shakes in the fighting line."
"Skin and bone and ugly witted. But Andy with a blade. Happen he wasn't there last night, for it would have suited him to stab someone in the dark. If he causes trouble, I know where to find him."
"Last night?" Tulkington said enigmatically, raising his head to look at the roof beams. The thought of Trotter free did not seem to trouble him. "Do we need to examine that, John? All that mayhem was far from as it should have been."
"Would have been safe if it had been just the Spafford lot,"
Hawker protested, stung by the criticism.
"Could have seen to them without too much trouble. The others, well..."
The implied question was left hanging, and with it John Hawker's curiosity about what he would dearly love to know. Had the near simultaneous arrival of Brazier and his tars been a coincidence, or was it anticipated? If the latter, he should have been forewarned so it could have been dealt with, possibly before they even got into the grounds. His recollection was vague on what happened after the discovery of their presence due to the incapacitating clout he took in the dark from one of their number. Tempted to inquire, he held his tongue. Any question there did not appear welcome, and he would probably whistle for an answer. This thought increased the feeling that had been growing on him these last few days, that things did not feel right between him and Tulkington. This disquiet he could date back to the first meeting, in a hilltop coach he and Daisy Trotter had brokered between his employer and Dan Spafford. It had taken weeks to arrange due to deep mutual suspicion, with no indication of distrust having been eased when it ended. Not that he'd been told anything. It was only later he found out things had been said. Not agreements, but telling facts of which he should not have been kept in ignorance. Prior to that day, John Hawker had felt himself trusted completely within the remit of his responsibilities, happily accepting there were areas of the whole to which he was not privy. The feeling of things not being as they were rendered him unhappy, but it was not his sole concern. To his mind, and he'd stated it before the events of the night, the way he'd been asked to deal with the Spafford lot was all wrong. Putting a cap on their thieving of his contraband had been the primary aim. Presenting them a chance to invade Cottington Court and taking them prisoner created a whole set of other problems. To his way of thinking, this made things worse, not better. His solution would have been to beard them on their own patch with superior numbers and mete out a sound beating, applied especially to their leader and his useless son. A good hiding was not something to go around boasting about. Very much the opposite. It would be a matter of shame. Tulkington, who had denied him the opportunity to do that, turned and faced Hawker, his expression giving nothing away, to ask about the men captured and where they were now.
"Locked up, chained together and under guard in the smaller cowshed."
"That eye of yours, it's bound to cause comment."
none of which will reach my ears.
The abrupt change of subject had thrown Hawker, and if the reply was stated with certainty, he was not about to put off his main concern.
Can I reckon from your mood, getting rid of Spafford's lot permanent-like's not favoured?
The response was terse, as if the notion was foolish.
That means over a dozen bodies, and too many questions. They're all men known in the town, and if they disappear...
Been known for a smuggling lugger to founder often enough,
Hawker persisted.
All hands going down.
The nod was an acknowledgement of a fact, but it did not extend to agreement.
Why are you so sure you can't trust them?
What I'm sure of, Mr. Tulkington, is I don't want to have to.
He might as well have said, for fear of blame, if they proved to be unreliable. Hawker was sure Tulkington got the point, but he did not do what was wanted, which was for him to accept responsibility.
Best you speak to them as a first step.
To say?
It might help to reassure them. Whatever happens, they're not going to end up in a pork barrel.
This was a rumour, given he ran the slaughterhouse, which fed into Hawker's reputation. It wasn't true that some of his victims ended up as cut and salted meat, food sent aboard departing ships where the barrels would not be opened for months. Nor did he sell on the skins of his victims to be made into the softest of saddles and other high-value artifacts. But it suited him to allow the story of such a fate to circulate. The thought induced a terrible fear in people who might be tempted to cross him.
For now, keep them fed until I decide what to do. And send a couple of your most reliable men up to Cottington with a covered cart tonight. The kind who know how to keep their mouths shut. They are to ask for me in person. I can't keep Dan Spafford in my cellar forever. So it's best he too is brought here with due discretion, but kept separate.
He of all should disappear.
Perhaps.
Was the enigmatic reply. Tulkington then pulled a letter from his pocket and handed it over, prior to putting on his gloves, a sure sign that for him, at this moment, the matter was dealt with.
I need you to see that delivered, John. It is an invitation to Brazier, that he depart, deal.
Ain't paid much attention afore.
That was occasion for a thin smile, and finally an explanation of what had taken place while Hawker was too groggy to register anything around him. It was one listened to impassively, though it as good as told him Brazier had been expected. He'd been kept in ignorance of the possibility and paid the price in both pain and pride. If he was seething inwardly, he could let nothing show on his face. Not that Tulkington noticed, he being too busy gloating.
Once it's delivered, the house has to be watched for signs he has heeded my instruction.
And if not?
Then pressure will have to be applied.
Hawker pointed a finger to his bruised face.
I need to get even for this.
A touch of exasperation came with the response.
There's a greater purpose at stake, man. I need him gone so matters can settle. My wish is that hope's dashed, he will just go. Your purpose,
Hawker was thinking,
not mine.
Edward Brazier sat at his writing desk, quill in hand, though yet to be dipped in ink, given he was wondering what to say. At the back of his mind was a nagging doubt, the thought that somehow Betsy had been complicit in what had occurred. Irksome because even if he did not really believe it, the thought would not go away. Normally a fluid penman, as a king's officer his rank involved endless correspondence. Being stuck for an opening was uncomfortable. He forced himself to write his address and the date, only to realize that could be unwise. The letter, taken in by a servant, could be opened prior to being handed to Betsy. This engendered another even more depressing possibility.
She might not get anything he sent to her at all. Yet he required certainty about what had happened, and only she could provide it, which led to thoughts that an intermediary might be required, one who could carry his messages verbally without them being intercepted. It might provide a solution, yet it was far from an easy one to execute. He'd been in deal for weeks now, but that did not change his status much in what was a taut society. He was still a stranger, and had few acquaintances locally who could bridge the divide between him and the woman he'd set out to marry. It was almost by its own volition that the quill moved, but it was not to write to her but to the Admiralty, on a subject with which he was familiar. The composition of his request for command of a ship required no real thought. If what followed was more prevarication, the letters he penned to various people, it served a purpose. They took his mind off his most pressing concern. There was one for his prize agent in London, requiring an update on his position financially. Others to naval acquaintances with whom he regularly corresponded, not least his first captain, now Admiral Sir Eustace Pollock. This always ended with a commitment to call upon him when time permitted, and that induced a pause. Pollock was not far away, in the hamlet of Adisham. Would keeping such a promise be a way of keeping his mind off his present difficulties? He felt very much the need to talk to someone, if only to pause the spin of speculation with which he was assailed. Much as he might seek to control his imagination and dismiss as absurd the more fanciful places to which his worries took him, he was failing, so the quill was thrown aside. Brazier stood up and made for the front door, grabbing his hat on the way. The slamming forced those who escorted him everywhere to rush to follow.
"Mood's not improved," opined Cocky Logan as he grabbed his weapons.
"Be a while, I reckon," was Dutchy Holland's response, "if ever."
Pedler was the last to join them in the narrow street, just in time to see their captain disappear, turning left and heading towards the lower valley road. He had in his hand the sheathed sword Brazier had left behind.
"Serve him right if he gets a sandbag round his ear hole."
Striding out, Edward Brazier had a look in his eye that tended to clear a path through anyone seeking to share his space, which, given his height and build, was not contained to begin with. For once, crossing the busy thoroughfare on which the town centred, the sweeper failed to get a coin for clearing the dust and dung. This had him stop and wonder, leaning on his broom, for the kindly Captain Brazier had never failed to tip him half a penny before. Said captain's destination was the old playhouse, a theatre and tavern where he hoped to find perhaps the one person to whom he could unburden himself without engendering useless pity. He didn't want sympathy. He wanted a way to proceed that did not involve skewering Henry Tulkington or putting a ball into his heart. That, as a solution, could not be, given he was dealing with a man, he was sure, who would refuse any challenge he issued. Despite that knowledge, the image of fighting the bastard filled his thoughts. So mercurial was he in conjuring up scenarios, it extended to dueling with both swords and pistols, in all of which there was a most delicious point of triumph, in which Betsy's brother expired as they embraced above the body. The thought could not be held. So by the time he went through the door of the old playhouse, he was scowling again to find the person he sought in her tiny den cum office just off the card room. She was sat with a quill in her hand and a ledger open on what passed for a desk, one piled with bits of paper in various stacks, all bills. Saoirse Reardon looked up at her visitor, a smile of greeting only halfway to completion when it faded. The glare with which Brazier was looking at her made that seem inappropriate, so it was replaced with one of open inquiry, added to a touch of annoyance.
"Well, you look to be in cheer of the day. I'd offer you a chair, except I'm in want of one spare."
I need to talk to you.
Came out through clenched teeth. The woman he was addressing was not one to be trifled with, so his tone got what it deserved.
Well, I'll be seeing if you do. That's not the manner likely to get you your wish.
It's important, Cersei.
So is what I'm about, Edward. These figures will not do themselves, and you know. Only the Lord knows why I trusted to let on to you, why I can't leave him to another.
Brazier just shook his head with a look in his eye that left little doubt he had no interest in her concerns. So she added,
Hawker will be along later today, and I must have them make sense.
If not truth. The quill was put down and she turned in her chair to look up at him, green eyes showing her clearly confused.
Have you been at the battle?
His face lost the angry look. Indeed, it could have been said to fall. Saoirse was not thinking that had been caused by the words she'd used. Indeed, she was speculating here was a man who might benefit from a stiff drink, quickly offered.
I reckon that to be the last thing I need.
Which leaves me wondering what it is you do want for.
Someone to talk to.
Was delivered with a weary tone.
Who will help me make sense of what has happened, though I think it defies that commodity.
It was a measure of her sagacity that Saoirse did not inquire. She waited for several seconds to allow him to gather his thoughts, and nor did she interrupt as he told his tale. She was not aware it was filleted out with no mention of Hawker and the presence of a whole host of other bodies. Brazier related it without holding her eye. In fact, he seemed to be talking to the shelves full of ledgers behind her head, which did allow Saoirse to display the shock she felt without him noticing. He stopped speaking eventually and did engage her to find a slow, shaking head. When she spoke, her Irish accent was more pronounced than normal.
I can scarce believe it, and to be sure I've heard some tales in my time.
Saoirse stood up and held out a hand to take his, achieved without protest.
We shall go upstairs.
These,
Brazier said with a wave of his free hand towards the desk.
We'll wait,
was said softly. Brazier followed her out to recall, as he reached the stairs to the upper floor, the last time he had ascended them, or, to be nearer the truth, was half carried up and in real pain from several bruises and a cracked rib. The blurred memory of the reason followed, the surprise of the assault as night was falling, not many yards from the old playhouse door, the way he'd been dragged into an alley to be punched and kicked, with his own responses feeling more feeble in reverie than they had probably been in fact. It was luck more than fighting ability that got him out into the street, where what was happening could be seen, even more so that the two toughs who guarded the door of the old playhouse came to his rescue. Had it been an act of charity on their behalf, or had Saoirse, for whom he'd been idling while waiting, sent them to aid him, he'd never asked.
Harriet, Saoirse called before entering her parlour. Fetch your cloak. Go to Mr. Hawker. You know where he's to be found. He will not yet be doing his rounds. Ask him if he can call tomorrow instead of today. I think you'd best sit,
she added, once she joined Brazier inside.
Do you want anything to drink?
No.
Would it hurt you if I asked you to tell me a second time what happened? I'm struggling to make sense of it.
You're not alone.
Brazier sat silently for some time before speaking, and as he reprised for her what he'd gone over 100 times already in his own mind, he felt a sense of futility and confusion.
I cannot clear from my mind the interior of that damned room, Saoirse, and that bastard of a brother of hers. If you ask me now, I wish I'd put a ball in his brain.
The frown, if he'd seen it, his eyes were cast down, would have shown Brazier that Saoirse Reardon was at one with Duchy in her view. She said nothing more until he was done.
You're sure of the name Spafford?
Believe me, it's etched in my mind.
Well, I can tell you the drunken divine, not that he's ever sober, is called Moyle, and he's a disgrace to the cloth.
I know of him. Betsy told me. But his habits are of no consequence. He is a priest and has the right to marry.
Half statement, half question. It was acknowledged with a nod.
And just who is this Spafford?
He's the son of a local smuggler.
Damn me, Saoirse.
Came with real vehemence.
Is there a soul in Deal who is not?
Rare, I will grant. But the mystery, to me, is why him?
The look he gave her invited her to go on, which she did, and what he heard affected both his anger as well as a sense of hopelessness. Had Tulkington deliberately chosen such a disreputable creature to send to him a message?
Edward, the insult will be felt by your lady more than you. If Harry Spafford is not poxed to the eyeballs, it'll be a miracle.
It must be set aside,
he hissed with deep, if frustrated, passion.
I need to know how it can be done.
Then you need to talk to a priest, for only one such will know how to go about it.
It took only a moment's thought before she added,
The Reverend Benjamin of St. George's along the way comes across as a decent man, able to nod to a papist like me without blushing or begging forgiveness.
Is he a discreet man, Saoirse? For this cannot be bandied about.
And how do you reckon it to be kept secret in a place like this? Sure, have I not already told you, Deal will invent a rumour if none already exists. You cannot but see this, sad as you find it, as a juicy tale.
Her reputation
will suffer. I cannot see how it will not.
She pursed her lips.
It might be best to consult a lawyer before speaking to Mr. Benjamin, though he is high church enough to respect the confessional.
Do you have a name? The man who contracted for my rental?
I'd caution against one local. Not that we're overburdened. Henry Tulkington has too many in the town in thrall to him, and I have no idea if one of them is the man I employ.
After a moment's thought, she added,
The matter is ecclesiastical, which minds me to say, find one in Canterbury.
I must find a way to communicate with Betsy, Saoirse.
There I doubt I can aid you, but I will put my mind to it.
Brazier emerged from the old playhouse to be greeted by the frown of those who had followed him and were waiting outside, while Duchy Holland was not going to allow his rank to spare him a vocal complaint.
That bastard Orker is not going to forget how he got belted, and if I was the one who landed him one, he'll take it out on whoever he can find. So don't you go dashing off like that again without you letting us know.
It was a meek post-captain in King George's Navy, a man that ruled like a monarch when at sea, who acknowledged the rightness of the reprimand. He did not know it, but it was that trait in his personality, the ability to admit he was not always right, which had helped to make him a popular commander. That and the obvious concern for the welfare of his men. No one would, of course, tell him, to his face, such a thing. Chapter 5 Daisy Trotter had woken up to an empty house, which was far from normal. Though silence he was accustomed to. When they were not engaged in running or moving contraband, he was usually the first one abroad of a morning. He took responsibility for getting the fire going and the pots slung in the ingle nook for hot water and breakfast. He took delivery of bread and milk brought from the local baker and the dairy farm, then raided the weekly stocked larder for ingredients, with the rest of the inhabitants called to attend when the food was ready. The Spafford gang had not just smuggled together. They lived hugger-mugger in a ramshackle farmhouse on the western edge of the village of Worth. Maybe it was Dan Spafford's own less-than-happy experience with one woman, a liaison that had produced Harry,
which dictated his policy of no females living in. There were another couple of good reasons, loyalty to the group being uppermost, and keeping quiet about what they were up to day by day. A trip across the channel required to be planned well in advance, with those who took their goods called upon beforehand to list what they were prepared to shell out for. The actual crossing had to take account of the impending weather, but could not then be overly delayed, lest impatience send those same customers looking elsewhere. That involved guesswork in the reading of impending conditions, based on a deep, collective knowledge of the waters on which they would sail. Added to that was an ability to understand the elements, both as they were and what they would become. Much of it folk memory handed down through generations of coastal sailors. Someone with no part in the importation and sale of contraband or the profits from such, male or female, might gossip. If the men who followed and depended on Dan Spafford wanted comfort, they could get it in the fleshpots of Deal, where there was no shortage of places to take their ease, or whores willing to oblige their needs, many on the streets and willing to oblige for small copper. One or two, Daisy knew, had formed more lasting partnerships, but these were kept discreet and as such posed no problems. Harry Spafford was the opposite. Since he had reached maturity, he was ever to be found in one of said boroughs. Running up bills for women and drink, his overindulgent pa was obliged to settle. It was eerie, padding over the cold flagstones, knowing there was no one else about, enough to bring on the creeps, and that was before he even thought more about what had happened and any way to proceed. It was easy to allow imagination to run riot, conjuring up images of what Hawker might do to the lads who only yesterday had bustled about the place yawning, scratching, exchanging jesting insults, all well-worn, to be taken with mock offence and general laughter. "No laughter now, Daisy," he murmured, as he cleared the grate of the previous day's ash. The act of laying dry kindling and small logs was carried out automatically. Likewise, he supposed, the next act, lighting the taper from the oil lamp on the mantel. It was one normally never allowed to go out, being topped up as the last thing carried out at the end of the day. Not last night. He'd been too preoccupied to see to it on his return. That it was so just drove home his isolation and left him looking for flint and steel to get the necessary spark, as well as some dried grass. The latter was doused in turpentine, so took quickly. When he got a proper flame, he stood back in contemplation and watched it spread to the kindling, then heard the cracks as the wooden logs began to heat and finally burn. A blaze going, he added thicker wood, but there was only one hanging of a pot, that for water. Why bother with the others, given no one was here to eat anything? So he just remained, staring into the fire. His brown study was broken by the door knocker, so he went to take delivery of the bread, bringing in, as well, the large earthenware jug of milk and block of butter and fresh eggs the farmer had left on the stoop. Chewing bread, still warm, spread with butter and a cherry preserve he had made himself, washed down with creamy milk, he literally sat and chewed the cud. The priority was to try to find out what had happened to Dan and the lads. Then, if what he feared had come to pass, indeed, regardless, he must find and have words with this Captain Brazier. First he had some with himself. "Might come to out, Daisy. But who's to know till it's attempted?" Several ladles of water, now hot, were transferred to a bowl, to be taken into his room and placed under the looking-glass. Gazing at the image brought little comfort, given he had a nose wider than normal, with black bruising either side. This rendered a face well off being handsome, even more depressing. It brought to mind the joke often made by his mates, taken as a jest, which said he looked so rodent-like that satisfaction, if he sought it, could always be had behind the skirting boards.
It had been possible to forget he looked even worse now, like some kind of ogre, as it had been possible to bury the cause of these afflictions, none other than Harry Spafford. His pa had dragged him home from the company of two whores and drink, to be locked in a room to sober him up as well as keep him away from further debauchery. The gang were about to steal some of Tulkington's goods, and Dan wanted his boy along, not that Harry showed any sign of being keen to go. No one else but his father had been allowed into the locked room, even down to taking in his meals and fetching away the empties, night soil included. It had begun to have an effect, though some of the screams that came from within on the first night spoke of the depth of Harry's demons, which would ease as time and abstinence saw his dependence of drink exorcised. When Dan and the lads went off on their raid, Daisy, not seen as robust enough for the task, was left in charge. The memory of what happened triggered a whole raft of reminiscence, going back all the way to when he and Dan had been but boys. It may never have been returned in a way he would have wished, but he loved the man. Daisy had extended something of the same feelings to Harry, acting like a surrogate parent, a replacement for his absent mother, which saw him looking at the image of a fool in the looking-glass. It had been Harry who had head-butted Daisy and given him his bruising, to then skip past him and escape. But it was the manner in which he had soft-soaped him beforehand, playing on his affections and suppressed desires, which hurt the most. The pricking of the eyes he tried to dismiss and fight off, but within seconds, Daisy Trotter was weeping, his head in his hands, his shoulders racked at the feeling of a life wasted. Edward Brazier came home to find Quebec House smelling of freshly brewed coffee, and Vincent Flaherty sat in his parlour. Much as he esteemed the horse dealer, if he had few friends in Deal, Flaherty could be said to be one, he was not really in the mood for his endemically cheerful presence, and it showed, which led to a hurried excuse. "Joe insisted I take coffee."
"He would."
This was delivered with little grace, which unsettled a guest, accustomed, if you excused the odd lapse, to good humour. He didn't respond as Dutchy and the others, with a fair amount of clatter, relieved themselves of their cutlasses and pistols. Flaherty waited till they'd passed down the hallway and the parlour door, before posing an obvious question with some degree of pique.
"You're out of sorts, I can tell. Am I to be afforded a reason?"
"You do not think it might be a private matter?"
"If that is what you will say it is, so be it."
Brazier turned to look out of the window. Not that he could see much, no more than the warm brick wall and windows of the house opposite. Across a street so narrow, two carts would struggle to pass.
"If I'm not welcome, Edward..."
"Forgive me,"
was said with a back still turned.
"I'm somewhat in shock."
Flaherty, near to being the first person Brazier had dealings with since he arrived in Deal, had become intimate enough to know of his reason for being here. Both being men who made friends easily, he and Brazier had bonded. The Irishman had even acted as a sort of spy, seeking to find out who'd been responsible for his beating, the clue being that those assaulting him had more than once, when driving home a verbal threat to go with their blows, used the mysterious name of Daisy. Vincent could give him no clue to Daisy's identity, so had been dispatched to roam through the taverns of the town, given everything in Deal revolved around such places. His task was to seek out the identity of this lady, someone who Brazier had so unknowingly offended. Not that information had been readily forthcoming until very recently, when Daisy had turned out not to be a woman, but a man called Jaleel Trotter. He was said to be an expert at the silent knife, a fellow who'd gained his sobriquet from his sexual proclivities.
Do I sense Mrs. Langridge is at the center of this shock?
Vincent asked softly. The turn was slow and the look on Brazier's face enough to confirm to Flaherty he had the right of it.
She's changed her mind.
Worse, Vincent. Much worse.
When Betsy called for outdoor clothing suitable for walking, nothing was said. Yet Grady had about him an air that was beyond odd. It was common that a retainer would not directly catch the eye of the master of the house, for very sound reasons given his crabbed personality, but that had never applied to Betsy. She had grown from child to woman under this very roof, and had been both as charming, entertaining, and sulky as a girl going through adolescence could be. Being married, albeit only for a short time, had made no difference, and neither had it been so when she came home from Jamaica as a widow. Her relations with the servants had always been good, utterly at odds with that of her somber and humorless sibling. She longed to ask Grady for his thoughts, but that was, of course, debarred by their differing stations. The whole house must be abuzz with speculation on this sudden marriage. It would have been even more so on a subject she had managed to keep secret. They knew of Edward Brazier and his attentions, but not what had been planned for them both the previous night. What would they have said if they'd known of the plan to elope? The thought was interrupted by her aunt appearing on the stairway.
"Where are you going, Elizabeth?"
"For a walk," was delivered in a biting riposte. "I assume I can still do that.
If you wait, I will accompany you."
"No." Betsy, by her acid tone, added to the glare with which it was accompanied, might as well have said that was the last thing she desired. This had Sarah Lovell redden slightly, being in receipt of what sounded very much like a reproof, one delivered in front of a servant, making it so much worse. Her niece did not wait to give her a chance to respond. Pulling on her gloves, she rushed out of the front door before Grady could open it for her.
"Does madam require anything?"
he then asked, looking up at the stony-faced older woman.
"No, Grady, nothing. But the young man, we had moved. What of him?"
"He sent down for a tray of food and some wine, madam, and demanded a bath be fetched and filled. All have been attended to."
Grady was well practiced in the art of disguising disapproval. Yet the way he used the word demanded spoke volumes. Harry Spafford had, by his peremptory call, wasted no time in making himself unpopular with those below stairs. Sarah Lovell, with an air of resignation, nodded and retreated back up towards the first floor landing. The walk took Betsy on a familiar route, one she had traversed many times since childhood, with both friends as well as her future husband, Stephen, who had been one of them. That was long before either even contemplated they might one day marry. But affection had grown between them to the point where nothing could have seemed more natural. It was a bitter reflection that Henry had objected to that too, seeking, with their father dead, to act as if he had the right to decide. The arguments that ensued did not entirely replicate those she'd had over Edward. It was more about their youth and the unsuitability of a young man with few prospects. That had abruptly changed when, following on from the death of an uncle, Stephen Langridge had inherited his plantations. The path led from the side gate of the formal garden down a tree-lined track to wind its way round the lake. Betsy decided, once she reached that, just in case she was being observed, to go round the left-hand side. It was a longer route, which would in time bring her to the place she had so many times met Edward Brazier in secret. It was also the place where he had eventually become more than a mere suitor. This engendered another memory,
for it was on this very ground they had quarrelled about Henry, as Edward had told her of his nefarious activities, accusations that she refused to countenance as true. It was also the spot, once the scales had fallen from her eyes, where they had decided on marriage and planned her escape. Before she approached the bushes, which hid from view the old postern door by which Edward had come and gone, she made great play of picking some wild daffodils, which allowed her to